It's my pleasure to introduce Ian MacDonald and an individual and a name that is well known to you all. Ian has fine insights into the happenings of the day, and he sets them in a wonderful historical context. He has done that as an author, and he has done it, my association with Ian, most impressively as a person who puts wonderful words into the mouth of political leaders. And he has done that for a long time, and I can still remember some of those phrases.
Nice to see you, Bob. Thank you, Bob. It's, first of all, an honor to be here with my friend Bob Slater, a great Canadian. If we have an acid rain accord with the United States, the 20th anniversary of which we observe next March, it is due in no small measure to the outstanding leadership that Bob provided when he was senior associate deputy minister for policy at Environment Canada. And I can tell you an anecdote. In 1988, we were working on a speech for the prime minister to the United States Congress, a joint address, as they call it, and a major part of the address was about acid rain. And we were trying to dramatize the issue in a way that the could get the attention of the Americans. And so we put a line in along the following lines. Acid rain falls on the White House, it falls on the roof of this building, the Capitol Dome, and it falls on the lake in New Hampshire where they filmed on Golden Pond. And I sent the draft to 24 Sussex in the briefcase, and late that night the phone rang and it was him. And in that famous baritone, he said, "Where did you get that?" And I said, "From Slater." And he said, "Okay." But then he pulled out, in the delivery, he pulled out the line about on Golden Pond. And afterwards, back at the Madison Hotel in Washington, I asked the Prime Minister, "Why did you take that out?" He said, "I wanted to share that as an anecdote with Reagan because Henry Fonda is his best friend." So thank you, Bob. Bob wears the Order of Canada, and believe me, he earned it. We saw Nick's research. It kind of sets the table. It's in the special issue of policy options that's in your delegate kit. And we have an outstanding panel to kind of do a reality check on water and the importance to which we attach to it. As you can see from Nick's poll, it's a very emotional issue. People take ownership of water. It's associated with other issues such as Arctic sovereignty and so on. But we do take it for granted a little bit, until sometimes when you see, you know, the Minnesota license plate, land of 10,000 lakes. Heck, we've got a million right here in Quebec, so we are a superpower in water. The question is, what do we do with it? And we have an outstanding panel that we've assembled this morning, Bob Sanford, Jim Bruce, Chris Hilcane, and Karen Baker. And you see their resumes in your conference program. I'm not going to read them through. We're just going to try and whip through their presentations in about 8 to 10 minutes each. We'll hold a clock on them, and then we'll have a wraparound among the presenters, and then we'll get to Q&A. So we'll start with Bob.
In the context of water resources management, there are a host of areas of dispute and potential conflict that we urgently need to address in Canada. We should be dealing with these problems now while time and prosperity are on our side, so that as our population grows and our climate changes, our social and economic development is not limited by water availability and water problems or quality problems we could have and should have addressed in better times. In order to get our water resources management house in order, the first thing we need to do is to dispel some of our own myths before nature does. The first myth we have to dispel is that we are world leaders in the management of water resources. We are not. We are among the world's great water wasters and polluters, and the business opportunity that resides here is in realizing and changing that. Nor do we have as much water as we think. If we do not dispel the myth of limitless water abundance in Canada, we will continue to make contentious public policy choices based on false assumptions of how much water we have that could have undesirable ecological, social, and political consequences in the future. Another myth we have to dispel is that the marketplace will take care of all of our emerging water issues. Better pricing and more open markets will serve to assign water a higher economic value in its economic functions. Better pricing and more open markets generate healthy competition that will discourage wasteful and unproductive uses. Markets alone, however, cannot solve the real problem that we face. The real problem we face is that we lack a set of principles and guidelines that stop us from chipping away at natural systems until there's nothing left of their life-sustaining functions, which the marketplace fails to value adequately, if they're valued at all. Another myth we have to dispel is that proper management of water resources is going to make everybody happy. Very difficult trade-offs will mean that consensus will not be achievable on all water issues. This means that higher levels of government will have to assert leadership on important water matters. To get our house in order and to avoid dispute and potential conflict in the future, we need more consistent, accurate, representative, and relevant monitoring of ground and surface water, and we have to share interpretations derived from such monitoring far more effectively. The alarming state of our country's groundwater resources was put into relief in 2009 in a report by the Council of Canadian Academies. This report evidences the fact that contamination of groundwater aquifers is widespread all over the country. We are even contaminating aquifers that we share with the United States. To get our house in order, we have to understand the link that exists between ground and surface water and stop denying the seriousness of groundwater issues in this country. Most Canadians have yet to make the link between water use and energy costs. Water is heavy. It takes a lot of water to produce energy, and we use a lot of the energy we produce to move water around so it can be available for use when we want it. We can avoid conflict over water use and energy security by understanding the link between the two. If you save one, you're likely saving the other. The management of water resources in the context of continued oil sands development in the Athabasca River Basin is already in dispute and represents an area of elevated conflict that casts Canada in a poor light on the international stage. And regrettably, we appear to have given up trying to resolve that dispute. All sides appear to be relying on public relations to carry the day. The oil sands have become a public relations Afghanistan. It's a war that we could all lose. We simply cannot afford to let crucial water issues be hijacked by the same kind of public relations spin. But that is happening. Even though it may not be visible, a quiet public relations war is being fought in Canada over who's going to have control over our water in the future. This shouldn't surprise us, but it's important to know that, and we have to demand transparency in public discourse over water issues. Legal settlements with the Piikani people related to the Old Man River Dam dispute in Alberta make it clear that First Nations, depending upon the conditions set out in their treaty, can be entitled to water first before any other user. The Piikani settlement could dramatically affect the established first-in-time, first-in-right allocation mechanism on the Great Plains and in other parts of the Canadian West. But it may not just be first in time, first in right that is affected. Many treaties include clauses related to First Nations rights to water quality as well as quantity. And what this suggests is it's only a matter of time before our failure to adequately and consistently address long-standing human rights issues alters existing water allocation and use rights in Western Canada. And as that happens, we should expect conflict. In some parts of Canada, irrigation districts have rights to 70% of the water allocations. To some, that seems like an awful lot. And at the moment, at least, the irrigation community appears to be unwilling to accept that there's anything to dispute. They are standing fiercely by legal interpretations of first-in-time, first-in-right licensing, or FITFER, as it's called. And why not? But when you think about it, it grants them all the water they want first, even in a drought, and even if it means legally denying towns and cities around them the drinking water they need for survival. The running joke outside of agriculture, however, is whether FITFER is fit for the 21st century, but you can bet not everybody's laughing at that joke. There's more to this, though it is almost a heresy to say so. If we want to avoid conflict over water in the future, we need also to improve our agricultural practices. The fact is that certain kinds of agriculture have a big impact on water quality. Agricultural water use is becoming an issue globally because contemporary industrial-scale food production practices inevitably result in reduced return flows to nature of water of poor quality, which diminished and often water-starved natural aquatic ecosystems no longer have the capacity to purify. And this results, of course, in eutrophication. Eutrophication is the nutrient over-enrichment of rivers, streams, and lakes with fertilizers and manure carried by runoff. Thousands of Canadian lakes and watercourses are now suffering from varying degrees of eutrophication. And as we see from Lake Winnipeg, this is not a minor problem. And I predict that unless there are measurable improvements, that within 5 years the Canadian public is going to come to realize that agricultural runoff is one of the biggest contamination threats to the country's surface water resources. There are growing concerns about increasing amounts of endocrine-altering substances finding their way into our water supplies. And in his recent book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It, Robert Glennon reports that up to 90% of the drugs we take leave our bodies unchanged and still active. And although it's a rather crude joke, Glennon goes on to suggest that dirty old men cartoon characterizations won't mean the same thing if men start getting uncontrollable erections from somebody else's Viagra. He then indicates that that will certainly get everybody's attention. So to avoid dispute and conflict, we have to convince the public that reuse technology is necessary, safe, and reliable. We now realize that in order to provide water and other benefits to people, that nature needs water too. Moreover, nature needs a lot more water to provide benefits to people than we thought, and it follows hence that nature can't be where we send water as a last resort. And the first lesson that we might derive from international example is that public policy in Canada would be wise to move forward toward supplying adequate water to nature before over-allocation for human purposes makes it difficult to do so. And I predict in Canada that this will be an explosive issue. While disagreements about science are central to our inaction on climate change, we're now beginning to see also that disputes over climate change are being used as a proxy for much deeper conflicts between opposing ideologies and competing visions of the future. Whether we believe in climate change or not, the Arctic is changing faster than any place on Earth, and the people of the North know that sustainability demands something from everyone, but it won't be long before they grow weary of being among those of whom great sacrifice is tacitly expected, but to whom few benefits flow. If Southerners simply deny that climate change impacts exist, then they don't have to face the moral consequences of destroying the landscapes and livelihoods of their northern neighbors. And to a growing number of observers, that makes climate change denial both immoral and unjust. So sooner or later, the unfair distribution of benefits and burdens associated with climate change impacts will spark conflict, probably right here in Canada. So once again, stay tuned. I believe that all of the areas of potential dispute that I've mentioned can be resolved through patient, mutually respectful collaboration informed by goodwill and sound science. But all the science in the world's not going to help you if you don't use it. We have to act, and I think there are three potential avenues of policy reform. We can revitalize the current system by activating unexercised jurisdiction and harmonizing federal, provincial, and municipal oversight with respect to the management of our water resources. Alternatively, we could water policy reform in Canada could emerge from the example of others. Within the European Water Framework Directive, water quality standards and parameters of aquatic ecosystem health are defined by the European Union. Individual nations are then charged with meeting those standards by whatever means they feel will work best in local circumstances. A third avenue of reform might be to allow regions to reform water policy on a large-scale watershed basis. Integrated regional water policy could emerge at the major basin level, as is occurring now around the Great Lakes. Or alternately, all three options might be combined to create an integrated new Canadian water ethic. In closing, let me say that it's a good time to press for Canadian water ethic. As Nick Manos pointed out, the majority of Canadians consider water our most important natural resource, even more important to our future than oil. And this was confirmed again in an Ipsos Reid, RBC, and Unilever poll that suggests that the Canadians still feel this way. The point that I would like to make in closing is that, unlike so many other places in the world, Canada still has room to move in terms of how we manage our water resources. Well, we should get moving while we still have that room. Thank you.
Jim Bruce is next.
Thank you, Bob. I call my junk mail file on my desktop the Viagra file. I think I'm going to have to rename it. But thank you for a very thoughtful opening presentation. We're now going to hear from James Bruce, who is the former co-chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Thank you. Not quite the whole panel, just one of the working groups. I think it's very encouraging to me to hear several of my predecessors at this podium talk about the link between water and climate change. I'm going to elaborate on that a bit more and focus primarily on the Canadian situation. Which one do I push?
This button, sir.
That one. Thank you. No, didn't move.
What's the matter with my computer? Sorry about that.
Okay. Just before the big meeting in Copenhagen on climate change, where the countries struggled manfully but and womanfully, but didn't reach any agreement on how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions around the world. The Los Angeles Times, from an area which is short of water and already experiencing serious effects of climate change, had this excellent opinion piece about how water should inform the discussions on climate change and how the working draft that was developed for the conference was withdrawn for some reason, which nobody quite understands, because it seems to me that through impacts on water, the reality of climate change becomes more evident to many people. Where do I find next? Okay, there we go. David Schindler the other day presented something similar to this, but let me explain it a bit more. If you calculate the amount of energy introduced into the lower part of the atmosphere to change the climate from natural sources and from human-induced sources, greenhouse gases, you can produce graphs that look like this, where the blue bar is the temperatures you would expect from the natural external forcing, and that is the changes in the sun's energy reaching the Earth due to sunspots and Earth's rotation and so on, and from volcanic emissions. The red bar is the temperatures you would expect from greenhouse gases. And this graph just shows the ones for North America, the global values, and the global land values. And you can see that up until about the 60s, the natural forcing factors were very important in influencing the shifts in global mean temperatures and global climate. But since about 1970, we've seen the greenhouse gases reach a point where they entirely dominate the trend that we're seeing, the warming trend we're seeing. This has a couple of implications. One is it means that since about 1970, we should have seen some impact of climate change. And secondly, that since greenhouse gases are going to dominate the climate for the next four or five decades with the failure of Copenhagen, we should think of the trends we've already seen as being a pretty good indicator of what we might see in the future, although possibly accelerating. Well, how have these trends played out in Canada? I still haven't quite figured this. Ah, there it is. Well, there are two things that I'd like to talk about as factors which really influence water systems. One is the temperature trends, and this is the temperature trend from 48, which includes some of the stuff due to the changes in the sun's energy and so on. But it's mostly from, well, a lot of it's from 70 on. And you can see that we had temperatures as increases of 3.5-4 degrees C in the north and the northwest, coming down to about 1 degree C or half a degree C in parts of Ontario and Quebec, and little change on some of the East Coast areas because of changes in ocean circulations that was brought about by the changing climate causing cooling up until about 1990 in that area, with warming since about 1990. If we'd had a graph, if I'd been able to find a map from 1970 on, this area would have been yellow or pink too on the East Coast. Now, as the atmosphere warms, it holds more water vapor. And okay. I've got to do three things. as the atmosphere warms, it holds more water vapor. And that's sometimes called precipitable water. That means that when the atmosphere gets geared up to rain or snow, the intensity of the event is going to increase. And this is what we see. The blue and black areas are areas in the world since about the 60s that have shown increased frequency of high-intensity rainfalls. So we think we have the warming temperatures, we have more high-intensity rainfalls. Do I push that one first or that one? There we are. Now, if you look at high-intensity rainfalls, the Soil and Water Conservation Society undertook a very major study for North America, which showed that soil erosion would increase substantially. Runoff from agricultural lands would increase, carrying with it the nutrients, which cause eutrophication, and the toxic chemicals into our waterways. If these intense rains become more frequent, that's going to happen much more often. In many urban areas, stormwater overflows into sanitary sewer systems result in direct waste discharge to water bodies, and the number of flooded basement incidents in our communities has been on a rapid rise. So we see this increased eutrophication and contamination of nearshore areas happening in the Great Lakes and Lake Winnipeg, many other water bodies, with both increased frequency of high-intensity rainfalls, increased intensity of agriculture, and spread of urban areas over larger regions. There we are. Not only does do we have the problems with water quality, with higher water temperatures producing more algal growth and the runoff from more intense rains, but we also have increased flood events. And these are happening all over the place. These are just two examples from far-flung places. In Toronto, this was the largest payout by the insurance industry that they can recall, with the failure of the bridge over on Finch Avenue and the loss of all the services that go with the bridge. And in Pangnirtung in July 2008, we had a very heavy rain event that turned a sort of a tranquil little creek that went through the middle of town into a raging torrent, washed out a huge amount of the thawing permafrost. This is on Baffin Island, and completely divided the town in two, washed out their bridges, and made life miserable for them for a long time. Well, at the same time as we've seen these increased intensity of rains and flash floods, we've seen a trend towards more drought conditions. And these are the ones over the world. And look at the bullseye over Alberta, and this is a century-long trend, bullseye over Alberta and Saskatchewan. So the drought that we experienced from 2000 to 2005, which is estimated to have cost the country about $5 billion, will be looked upon in future as rather benign as these trends continue. Oops. Jeez.
I'm going to lose your space in a second, sir.
You got to give me a minute or two.
Is that it?
Yeah. Now, I don't think things in Alberta are going to get quite this bad, it's not going to be pretty. Average flows of rivers in the south average flows in the rivers of the southern part of Canada, where most people live, have been on average falling. Average flows of the rivers of the north have been, in fact, rising. This graphs show, as examples, the two tributaries of the Mackenzie system. The Liard River which arises in the Yukon, which is getting a lot more snow from the open waters of the Beaufort Sea. And you see increased flow. The blue bars are for the Liard. And you can see that increased flow is occurring in most months, except for a few in the summer. On the other hand, the Athabasca River, which we've heard a lot about from David and from Bob, the flows have been going down quite steadily. And as it traverses that long distance across Alberta with greater evaporation, and it's going down especially in the winter months, when low flows are most critical for supplying the oil sands results. And unfortunately, as Bob pointed out the other day, all the environmental assessments and the work of the oil companies has taken an average of these flows, and yet since 72, you've seen these remarkable declines in the flow of the Athabasca River. We've heard from David about the wetlands and peatlands of the north, and these are very important because, first of all, they're an important reservoir of water, but they're also an important reservoir of carbon. And as the permafrost below them melts or thaws, the wetlands tend to disappear, and peatlands disappear, releasing methane, quite a powerful greenhouse gas, and leading to concerns about the question of possibility of a runaway greenhouse effect. Now, it's not just Arctic ice and permafrost that is melting, and ice roads that are melting and preventing resupply of communities of the north, but ice on the Great Lakes has been gradually disappearing. This shows the trend since 1973 in average winter ice cover on the Great Lakes, and you can see that this is substantially downward. This has a profound effect on the energy balance of these lakes and the ecosystems that live therein, and particularly produces a longer period of stratification where the warm water at the top is separated from the cold bottom water, allowing much more loss of oxygen from the bottom waters. Now, there's been some significant debate about climate science, but Henry Pollack put it this way: ice asks no questions, presents no arguments, reads no newspapers, listens to no debates. It's not bounded by ideology and carries no political baggage. It just melts. So any Canadian water policy or program has to include adaptation to changes that will require redoubled efforts to reduce erosion and urban sewage overflows, to conserve water in the south, to reduce exposure to flash floods. But we cannot address all the problems for ecosystems and for water quality through adaptation measures. We must get at the reduction of the rate of change of climate by reducing greenhouse gases. And Canada must, in its own interest, regain a leading role in global efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in order to protect our water resources for this and future generations. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. It's interesting that you led with that article, clipping from the LA Times. For those of you who are old enough to remember the famous movie Chinatown, which made Jack Nicholson a world star, what was the narrative underpinning of that movie? Water in the Los Angeles Basin. our next presenter is Chris Hill-Kane, who's the chair of the water program at the National Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy. Chris?
Uh, Well, thank you. Good morning, everyone. As was just mentioned, I'm going to be here to talk to you a little bit about the work that the National Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy is doing on water right now. If you're not familiar with our organization, I'll give you the soupy sales in 25 words or less description. We were created about 21 years ago by an act of Canadian Parliament to be an arm's length, an independent advisor on issues where there's an interface between the environment and the economy. A lot of people think of us as a think tank. I think that's probably an accurate description, but we also do more than that. We're seen as a convener and a catalyst of change when it comes to sustainable development. Most people know us recently for our work on climate change, particularly carbon pricing. You've heard about talk about carbon taxes, cap and trade. You've probably come across our work. But we've also been focusing a lot on water. And about a year and a half ago, we started a program on Canada's water and the future of our natural resources sectors. And that's what I'm going to talk to you about today. It's the program is broken into two phases, the first part being a diagnostic, so it's a problem definition. We're looking at current and projected water use by the natural resource sectors. And when I'm talking natural resource sectors, I mean agriculture, forestry, mining, and the energy sectors. And we're looking at the key issues facing those sectors. We're examining water management and governance across Canada. And we're trying to get a better understanding of the impacts of climate change, as Jim was just talking about. We are just finishing off the diagnostic, and that's the part I'm going to focus on today. But I also want to talk a little bit about phase two, where we get into the solutions. It's a phase that we're just starting, but at the end of the presentation, I'd like to give you a sort of a little forecast of what you can expect, and I think that'll tie in very nicely with Karen's presentation. So, why focus on the natural resource sectors? There are a number of good reasons, both environmental and economic. Primarily, those four sectors that I mentioned collectively represent the majority of water use in this country. Some estimates that I've seen say as much as 87% of water use in Canada is attributed to those four sectors. The data's sketchy. The estimates are, don't put too much faith in it, but it's a huge water use. The other thing is, it's pretty important to our economy. By the 2009 numbers that we've seen, it represents those four sectors represent 14% of GDP. They represent about 50% of our exports, and about half of that is energy-related. They also represent about 1 million direct jobs. When you get indirect jobs, you can see it has a pretty big part of our economy. And more importantly, the projections that we have between now and 2030 say that those sectors are going to grow by 50 to 65%. And they rely heavily on water. And even with increased efficiencies, we're likely to see consumption and water use go up. So if we're going to have a water reality check on the natural resources sectors, there's a few things that we need to understand. What are the most important water uses by the natural resource sectors? What are the critical issues surrounding water use for the sectors? Current actions and plans or lack thereof for addressing the issues? And future areas that we need to pay attention to now so that we can ensure we have sustainable water supplies in the future. Don't have a lot of time to get into detail on these things, but on the specific issues. But we do have a major report on this coming out towards the end of the spring. So stay tuned, and you can delve into it at that time. But here's just some general observations that we've had so far. The solutions to the issues when it comes to these sectors are as unique as the problems in themselves. For energy and the agricultural sectors, future water availability is a huge concern. And it needs a lot of attention for future planning. When it comes to mining and forestry, they are not nearly as concerned about availability for water because it's not quite as important to them in terms of their operations. But there, you know, you may see on a regional basis that those industries will be impacted as well. And all the while we're talking mostly quantity, all of those sectors have an impact on water quality, and so that's going to be an important factor going forward as well. Another thing we've noticed is that information and data concerning water use by the sectors is pretty spotty. In some cases, they have very good data. In some cases, it's not good or it's absent. So overall, the national picture of water use within and between the four natural resource sectors is highly variable, and it's really difficult to make comparisons based on the data that we have today. Another thing that we've learned is that all of the sectors are working to reduce their water use, either for economic or social reasons. There's a direct linkage between water use in the natural resource sectors and energy consumption. So economics of that is a pretty strong driver for water conservation. The public license to operate is also currently important and will continue to be an important driver of water efficiency and conservation in those sectors. But there are also some barriers noted by the sectors for improved water use. A pretty striking example is if you think of pulp and paper plants, mills. Their effluent regulatory requirements in terms of effluent concentrations actually sometimes mean that they have to inject more water to meet the concentration levels than is required. There are also a lack of incentives right now for innovation and research, particularly in the forestry industry, where they've seen a really a hard time over the last few years. So this is sort of the foreshadowing part. I guess we've identified what we think are four key issues that are the next phase is really going to get into. The first one being governance and management, the second being water resources and climate change, the third being the water energy nexus, and the fourth being that public license to operate issue. Governance and management is the most significant, I think, of all of them, and it's an often identified critical issue, and it's one that's while there will be a lot of learnings about for the sector, it's one that's transferable. You're going to see it have impacts for other sectors as well. A couple of the things that the sum up from that we've gotten so far is that we need a more collaborative approach to governance. We need a stronger engagement of the federal government. We need to review water allocation approaches across the country. We need a broader suite of policy instruments to drive improvements of water use. We need integrated watershed resource management approaches. And we need more complete, reliable, consistent, and verifiable water use information that is centralized and accessible. I'm not going to talk too much about water and climate change because I think Jim did a fantastic job and David Schindler addressed that as well yesterday, but that's the second big one. The third one is this water-energy nexus. From an industrial production perspective, water is needed to produce energy, and energy is needed to produce usable water. The sectors commonly identify financial savings through energy use reductions as a main driver for improving water use. And while there are some opportunities for conservation that where you're simultaneously reducing water use and energy use, there are going to be trade-offs at sometimes or direct conflicts. For example, when you get into the climate change issue, some people will argue if you want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and air pollutants. From the energy sector, you have to think about nuclear as one of the solutions. Well, nuclear power requires a whole lot of reliable water to produce that power. So you may actually have a water use issue that you create by trying to address a greenhouse gas emission issue. And lastly, I'll just mention the license to operate point. More than 8 in 10 Canadians currently believe that Canada will have a freshwater shortage problem if conservation measures are not put in place. And you have to contextualize that and say it's, you know, these are regional impacts that we're talking about, because some places will actually, under a climate change scenario, will have more water. And, you know, you've seen it from the polling presentation that we've had, and you've seen it in the media, everything. This is a growing concern. With the real potential for increased water use across the country, with the potential for more pressure to use the same water resources, possibly arising in competing uses, we have a challenge here where the natural resource sectors are going to be in competition with themselves as well as other users, and so the industry and governance both need to start addressing that now. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris, very much for that. And our final presenter is Karen Baker, Associate Professor and Director of the Program on Water Governance at UBC.
Je voulais remercier les organisateurs parce que je pense que le dialogue qu'on entame ici pourra avoir des conséquences très importantes sur les questions de l'eau au Canada. Donc merci et félicitations. So thanks very much to the organizers and congratulations. It's precisely this sort of dialogue that I think is necessary. As much as experts on water think they're repeating themselves, we need to be reaching the key constituents and get our message out. And this is what I think this sort of conference allows us to do. So thanks and congratulations to the organizers. Much of what I have to say you've heard in bits over the presentations that have been made up to this point at the conference. But I want to bring these various references to governance together and outline for you some of the key elements of the governance challenge we face with respect to water in Canada. My main argument is that in Canada, we have one of the weakest water governance frameworks in the developed world. This hinders our capacity to protect our water resources and even to assess whether our water is secure. The solutions I'll outline are pretty simple. We need to effectively regulate, adequately integrate, and we also need a new paradigm, a new vision of water governance, predicated on protecting water security, based on a notion of the importance of both ecosystem and human health. So to expand that claim, I'll begin maybe in an unusual place. This is Frederick Farley's iconic image of stormy weather in Georgian Bay, painted in 1921, now hanging in the National Gallery in Ottawa. This image and others like it are emblematic of our myths of water in Canada, pristine, abundant, constitutive of our geography, and so thus in some way constitutive of our national identity. And that's why I think threats to water are often perceived in Canada not just as practical problems, but to some degree as existential threats. And the debate over transboundary water exports and the illusions or delusions that we're sometimes subject to, I think it speaks to that myth. Over the past couple of decades, of course, threats to Canada's water and the need to dispel that myth have become more apparent. The media have had a field day. Many observers have chimed in and argued that the threats to our water are multiple and we need to do something about it. Let me just give you one example that we haven't touched on in any great degree, but we should. Drinking water quality on First Nations reserves. Over 75% of First Nations reserves across the country do not have reliable access to potable water. Over 100 of those communities live with permanent boil water advisories. Some of those have been in place for decades. Add to that the over 1,000 small and rural communities across the country, some of these are only half an hour's drive from major cities like Vancouver, that have water quality as bad as that in developing countries. And you start to get, in addition to water quality tragedies like Walkerton, you start to get a sense of the picture with respect to drinking water governance in Canada. Part of the issue with respect to drinking water is the fact that we are the only developed country not to have legally enforceable drinking water standards. We only have guidelines. Not all provinces and territories have taken those up. So it's no wonder that commentators like the Senate's Standing Committee on Natural Resources have termed the governance of Canada's water shocking and unacceptable. And they've been echoed by lots of commentators. Lots of the Flow Water Group are here today, the Council of Canadian Academies, the Auditor General's Office, the National Water Resources Institute. We could go on. What are those commentators saying? Well, they're arguing that there are two key issues. The first is that we don't adequately integrate. So let's back up, and why do we need to integrate water management? You often hear the argument that we need to do so. Well, water is a really messy resource to manage. Because it's a flow resource, it circulates through the hydrological cycle. It crosses jurisdictional boundaries. It's subject to multiple uses by upstream and downstream users, and it's critical to environmental and public health. So water managers need to be balancing competition between users at multiple scales, dealing with this geographical mismatch between hydrological boundaries and jurisdictional boundaries while ensuring public and environmental health. That's even before they're dealing with land use. And this slide is from Brad Stelfox, an amazing landscape ecologist out in Alberta. Map out agriculture, human settlements, transport, energy production and transmission. And you get a sense of the very fragmented land base that we deal with in most of the country. People living in urban centers in Canada often tend to overlook the extensive and multiple uses to which the land base throughout a lot of Canada is subject. All of these uses have impacts on the local hydrological cycle. If we can't get to grips with them in an integrated manner, we cannot protect water quality or even deal with water quantity issues, particularly low flows for ecosystem uses. So we need to integrate. We're not doing a great job. Why? It's because in Canada we have one of the most decentralized water governance frameworks in the world. It's partly a consequence of our approach to resource governance under Canadian federalism, where fresh water is the responsibility of the provinces, as with other resources. Nonetheless, we've allowed that decentralization to go on to an acute degree. We've also allowed for a significant amount of variation. You know, various different water rights regimes, lots of different approaches to things like drinking water standards, and I could go on. Now, decentralization and variation can be, to some degree, appropriate in a country that's as biogeographically diverse and as large as Canada, although other large federations have not taken the same approach. The EU, Australia, the US, they're all much more harmonized in terms of water regulation than we are. And the reason they've done that is they're trying to avoid some of the key problems that we're grappling with because of our framework. And the first is simply the sheer complexity of governing water that crosses boundaries when we've got all these multiple standards in place. The second issue is coordination failures. Lots of examples you've heard about. The kerfuffle over the Great Lakes Annex Charter, I think a few years ago, is another great one that hasn't been discussed. So this complicated governance landscape, coordination failures, and a third issue is duplication of efforts, which is vastly inefficient. To give you just one example, right, a bit of shameless self-promotion here. Here's the report. Right. We recently did a study of freshwater-related indicators across the country. Well, over the past 15 years, over 350 freshwater indicators have been created by provincial and federal governments. There's no central repository for data or even for the methods of these indicators. When confronted with the sheer number of indicators and their incommensurability, many local water managers throw up their hands. We surveyed a large number of them in last year, and they said, we simply don't use indicators. We'd love to. The system's not set up to allow us to do that. So we don't adequately integrate, and we don't adequately regulate. You've heard great examples of the regulatory vacuum across Canada. So I won't say much more about that, except to add one comment about the need for effective regulation. It has at least three elements: enforceable standards, monitoring that includes baseline data collection and enforcement. The fourth aspect of that, which some people like to add, is the transparent sharing of regulatory information with the public. I can log on to a website in the UK and find out in real time what the water quality of my drinking water system is anywhere in the country. In some jurisdictions in Canada, the best source of information on drinking water quality is a small Vancouver-based NGO called EcoJustice. They produce these national report cards. I mean, the contrast is stark. This graph is produced by someone who, at the Alberta Research Council. It gives you an idea of the intensity of water, groundwater abstraction over the past century in Alberta. You've heard before the issues we have with the inadequacy of groundwater mapping and the issues with groundwater quality. I threw it up just to remind us again of the intensity of use of the land base and water resources with respect to resource extraction. Here, I think, are where our key regulatory issues really lie. We do actually have a handle on drinking water. We could do a bit better at it. But the frameworks are there. They're not really there for resource extraction. And we don't really have a sense of what to do about that. The fact that major development in the tar sands proceeded without water allocation frameworks in place, without a framework for dealing with tailings ponds. Similar story in northeastern BC right now with respect to natural gas development. Hydraulic fracturing or fracturing, the injection of a mix of sand, steam, and a brew of chemicals into shales to extract low-grade natural gas. That's ongoing without basically any monitoring or regulation, in contrast to the better, not perfect, but the better regulatory frameworks they have in the U.S. So we don't regulate. We've abdicated in a lot of jurisdictions regulatory functions. And we're an outlier. We're an exception. Most other countries do it better. Some do it much better. So why? I've given you some of the reasons. We do have a general tendency with environmental governance in Canada to pass the buck because of the structure of resource governance under Canadian federalism. The geographical concentration of a population and the thin population density does mean resources are thinly spread. So the U.S. has 1.5 million hydrometric monitoring stations. We've only got a few thousand, and very few in the north. We have not grappled with the economic and political pressures associated with resource extractive sectors. If you effectively regulate, not everyone's going to be happy, as Bob said. I mean, smart regulation is too smart for its own good, I think, in this sense. I mean, effective regulation does mean making people, and sometimes very unhappy, and limiting land use. Finally, the myth of water abundance. You've heard a lot about it. We're not the Kuwait of the world's water. If you remember only one thing from this conference, please remember we have under 7% of the world's annual renewable fresh water supply. It's about equivalent to our land base, and it certainly doesn't mean, because a lot of that water is located in or flows to the north, that we have lots of excess. We can't be complacent. Other countries have woken up to this. The UK, for example, over the past 20 years has grappled with the fact that it's a water-scarce country. You wouldn't think it, given the permanent drizzle you seem to experience when you're there. Nonetheless, they have half the precipitation that Paris does. They have actually embarked on a sweeping set of legislative and policy changes that recognizes water-stressed areas, created very innovative mechanisms to deal with drought, very aggressive water conservation initiatives. Lots of other examples around the world of this, and we're a laggard. We weren't 40 years ago. The 1970 Canada Water Act and the suite of legislation that occurred in and around the Canada Water Act were world-leading. At the same time, we were one of the world leaders in water-related science. The federal government has not updated that legislation for 40 years. So we need to integrate. We need to regulate. We also need a new paradigm of water governance. Water professionals like to talk about integrated watershed resources management. That has way too many syllables to grab the general public. Here's another term I offer. We're working on a water security project at the moment, not in the sense of a narrow bioterrorist sense of security, but in a broad-based sense, you know, of integrating ecosystem health and human health, and ensuring access to adequate quantities and qualities of water on a watershed basis. It's this sort of vision that we need to underpin any governance renewal in Canada. So I agree with Bob that we're going to be resuscitating some frameworks, borrowing from elsewhere, looking strategically at delegated watershed governance. Linda Nowlin will talk about that a bit later today. But unless we have this underpinning vision, I think we'll fall into the same traps we already have because of the barriers I identified earlier. There are lots of great examples, particularly at the provincial level in Canada, that we haven't heard a lot about. The source water protection initiatives in Ontario, at least as originally envisioned, were, I think, extraordinary. I mean, source water protection was all about this very broad-based approach to dealing with the need to protect water sources from multiple uses and could have, and may still, imply the insertion of water governance considerations into land use planning in such a way as to prioritize the protection of water sources and to really constrain land uses in some areas. Rob DeLow might talk a bit more about that later on as well. So there are lots of examples at the provincial level. And in dealing with those examples, I want to address a question we were raised for this panel. The question was, what about the U.S.? And here I'm arguing, forget about the U.S. We're the greatest threat to our water. We're the greatest diverters of water in the world. We have, some of the weakest water governance frameworks in the world. We need to get our own house in order. I'll finish with some more shameless self-promotion. This is really terrible, but so this book brought together 28 water experts across Canada. It has a lot more information on the governance challenges and the solutions. The reason I throw it up, though, is it also ties in nicely to the presentation insofar as the proceeds of this book are going to the Waterkeepers. They're a national organization. You might know about them. They're eco-vigilantes. They get out there in their boats. They patrol the waters. If they catch polluters, governments or private companies or individuals, they try to prosecute. In many parts of Canada, they're our front line. They're the only ones who are defending our water sources. I think this is emblematic of the way we've abdicated collective responsibility for water in Canada. And if that's not the reality check message you take home, then I failed in my job. But I really want to emphasize the degree to which, and I hope the panelists will agree, we've got the science. We've even got the regulatory frameworks, but if we don't get the governance right, we won't have made progress. Thanks very much.
Just shut that down.
You want me to shut this
off? Yeah, just turn it off. Yeah, I just want to close the screen, okay? Thanks. Once again, policy, not operations. Thanks, Karen. I'm all for shameless promotion of authors in Canada. We need more of it, not less. And I'm sure that book is one of those available next door at the McGill bookstore, where you can also buy the famous McGill tie that Mike Babcock wore for the Olympic gold medal game. Just to put a little context, we're going to have a quick wraparound with the panel here before we do our Q&A in the half an hour that remains here. On Nick's, a little context on Nick's poll that you saw in his PowerPoint. He was in the field at the end of May last year at a time when the environment and water were nowhere in the news cycle, and there was no what we call coverage weights of water or the environment as an issue. We were at the end of the steepest economic downturn in 60 years, and the environment had fallen right off the table in terms of visibility as an issue. And yet, by a factor of three, Canadians chose water over oil and gas as our country's most important natural resource. That's a remarkable, what we call, bullet point. I've never seen a number quite like that. And then when you drill down in that and you asked, and I want to ask our panel their views on this, people's greatest concerns regarding fresh water in Canada, water pollution 40%, waste and overconsumption 22%, drinking water quality 18%, and bulk water exports, which is one of those, what I'm going to call grassy knoll myths that keeps floating around out there, 17%. So it's not really a big number. But the others, 40, 22, and 18.5 are. And they all relate to not just governance, as Karen has pointed out, but to federalism and the Federation and the division of powers in Sections 91 and 92 of the Constitution Act. And it goes to more than that, I think, Karen, and I'll give you each an opportunity to respond. Not just Ottawa and the provinces and territories, but municipalities, which are creatures of the provinces constitutionally. So I wonder, you know, if you were going to have a first minister's conference on water management, what would be the top item on your agenda? Karen, you take it first. We'll go down the table.
So you've hit on a key issue. Is this hot? Yeah. You've hit on a key issue with respect to the division of powers in the Canadian Constitution. It is both enabling and constraining, I think more constraining at this point, because it has inhibited, or the way we've interpreted it, with respect to resource governance, has inhibited a sensible dialogue about what they term the European Union subsidiarity versus harmonization. So on the one hand, you strategically harmonize. That implies some degree of centralization and standardization. It makes sense for some standards to be shared and mutually decided upon. That's why probably 80 to 85% of water quality legislation and policy in the European Union today is decided in Brussels, emanates from Brussels. So you harmonize, but you also strategically delegate water management to the lowest appropriate scale of governance. That's the subsidiarity part of this harmonization subsidiarity dialectic. Not using those terms, but in similar ways, the US and Australia, other federations, have gone through similar dialogues about the best way to deal with water issues. We've been blocked from doing that in Canada, not in other sectors, not in health, maybe to some extent, but certainly with respect to resource governance. Well, what does that mean? It means we only get part of the picture. Various provinces, for example, have tried to integrate at the watershed scale, and they've dealt very well, more or less, with the frameworks for horizontal integration, but not vertical integration. And that's what we're really missing in Canada. So the first item I'd have on this First Minister's Conference would be this issue of how do we deal with not only horizontal but vertical integration, and are we really interpreting the full scope of the degree to which we can engage in a national dialogue about harmonization?
Okay. Chris?
I actually could not agree more with that, but there was a time in our history where we did some of that. Provinces received transfer payments from the federal government, and they said, you are more appropriate to deal with this, even though it's our mandate. We had municipalities in Ontario specifically that benefited from conservation authorities, which were provincial agencies. Now they're not resourced anymore, and municipalities have to pay for it, so they don't use it as often because they can't afford to use it as often as they'd like to. So we have this kind of disconnect. So I guess my side would be, the one thing I would say is we need to have the integration that vertical and horizontal integration that Karen's talking about, but I think we just need to adequately resource a lot of the existing structures that we have. We've gutted our monitoring and data programs across the country. We've depleted our departments, whether they're federal, provincial, or municipal, when it comes to water and environment generally. I think, you know, if we staffed up, got some good expertise back in these places, we'd be more able to do the things that Karen is talking about.
Jim?
Well, I'll show my age. I think we had it within our grasp in the 70s. Karen mentioned the Canada Water Act, which was passed in 1970. And it was an enabling piece of legislation. It allowed the federal government to cooperate with the provinces on river basin planning on a comprehensive scale. It allowed cooperation for data monitoring. It allowed for cooperation for research. And it was a very powerful vehicle. But then, and a great deal of good was done during the 70s and early 80s. But then, as a result of budget reductions and so on, at a time when subsidies to the oil and gas industry were in the billions, a few tens of millions were taken out of that program that enabled this cooperation to take place. And the feds blew it all by becoming an unreliable partner with the provinces. And that legacy persists to today. And I'm only hopeful that the Canadian Council of Ministers of the Environment, and we'll hear a bit more from them later today, I think, may be a vehicle that will help to bring that back together again. I hope so.
Bob?
Well, first I'd like to respond to what Chris and Jim have said, and really it really talks about what Karen Backer is talking about. There have been some really dramatic changes that have escaped notice, and one of them is the extent to which environment ministries in this country have changed their purpose from environmental protection to environmental assurance. And that was a very subtle shift, which meant that they went from protecting these resources to actually finding mechanisms by which they could mitigate impacts of already approved projects. And in so doing, I work with provincial departments who have had their budgets cut by 75% in the last two decades, which is stunning in terms of failure to be able to meet duty and care obligations with respect to monitoring. And also what it does is dramatically reduce capacity within these departments, and our provincial and federal agencies are suffering dramatically from that. Finally, if I had a chance to talk to the First Ministers, one of the things that I think we really have to understand is how truly vulnerable we are to these matters that we're not addressing. And one of the things that I would like to point out is that Canada has a lot of dry areas. We don't know that living in the humid east, but this country has large, vast regions that are quite dry. And you want to avoid the vicious circle that has happened elsewhere where your allocation rights are granted, then you go to full allocation, then you cross the great divide of people competing with one another and with agriculture and with nature for water. Then you're really in trouble because you can't get water back for nature even when these needs have been properly characterized. This leads to ecological decline, normally expressed as desertification. And ecological decline leads to further climate instability, which can be tragic. And the point that I want to point out here is that, as Australia has shown, you can move along this vicious circle very quickly after you have deep and persistent drought. And as you move along that circle, you have fewer choices and fewer options, and it gets harder and harder to go back towards sustainability, and you move toward paralysis. So we need to tell our First Ministers that only a national water policy reform will work that links provinces and sectors and agriculture and water policy in a new and exciting way. And I think that we have the models elsewhere that we can use to start us down that path.
Well, I think what you're all saying is that it's a leadership issue and that this is something that we could perhaps email across town to Mr. Ignatieff at his Thinkers Conference here this weekend in Montreal. And if I could point out an example of federal-provincial collaboration on an environmental issue, the Acid Rain Accord that we finally got with the United States was preceded by an agreement that Bob worked on between Ottawa and the provinces, the seven eastern provinces east of Saskatchewan, to reduce their sulfur dioxide emissions by 50%, which enabled Mr. Mulroney to go before the United States Congress and say, "We ask nothing more than this from you," and it was leadership in federal-provincial relations that enabled that in the 1980s. Second question before we go to the audience. You're touching on implicitly fault lines of federalism here. Alberta's got the oil sands, Quebec's got water. Mr. Charest made very controversial comments at Copenhagen about the oil sands, which generated a huge blowback from Alberta, which is why we're having a debate about equalization in daycare in Canada now. How can we get this issue on the federal-provincial agenda in a way that's constructive and does not divide the provinces? Now let's come, Karen, why don't we just take it in the same order?
Let's go in the other order. Okay. So I'm still trying to flesh daycare with.
And I didn't like being first this morning because of the time change, and I just have to admit to you, I don't normally speak before 10.
Well, it's 11:45 in Newfoundland.
Yeah, that's right, to anyone. But I think that there's a real challenge here, and you know, we've looked abroad at why this doesn't get on the agenda in other countries, and other countries have the same federal-provincial style relationships. And researchers in the U.S. came up with this notion that this water falls under the area of domain or characterized as a predictable surprise. Everybody knows there's a problem, and everybody knows that it's getting worse. But they also, if you're a political leader, you realize that it's a complicated, emotionally charged issue, and that political gains are uncertain, and they're likely to be long in the distant future. And there's already somebody with vested interest whispering into the politician's ears, "It's okay, you don't have to do anything." And in fact, if you do, will cause you a lot of grief. So what you're finding is that this is a hard one to motivate leaders to overcome the types of problems federally and jurisdictionally. But we have to recognize what's happening elsewhere in the world. If you can get ahead of this, you can save yourself a tremendous amount of political grief and economic damage. And I think we've got to cultivate political leaders who will take charge of this in a committed, persistent way, and who will look at that federal-provincial thing as something that can be overcome and should be overcome before we find ourselves in a situation where we're forced to act.
Jim.
I have a naive hope about water. I think that every part of the country has serious water problems. Bob emphasizes the dryness of some parts of the West, but think of the problems of pollution and water levels in the Great Lakes St. Lawrence system, which have profound effects on the largest population centers of the country. I think that an active role on the part of the Council of Ministers of Environment and with some hopeful leadership by the federal government could get people working together on water issues. And that might create a pattern that would help overcome some of the difficult issues you've mentioned, Dean.
Okay. Chris?
Yeah, I think to build on what Jim is saying, once you can convince our politicians and so first convince Canadians that water really is our most important resource, far more important than the oil sands, you'll start to get some turnaround. I think that's a hard job to do because while we're all environmentally engaged and we're probably very familiar with what the oil sands do to our water and to our environment in general, I think the majority of Canadians, they live in the south. They don't know much about the north. They don't know what an oil sands development looks like. And they don't think it has an impact on them. And so it's hard to turn that into votes that's going to affect our politicians. So I think the reality is that one of two things have to happen. One, you're going to have to come up with a clear and present danger from the oil sands that's going to get a lot of immediate attention, and that will start to get attention in Ottawa and the provinces. Or the other thing that's going to happen is we're going to see our trading partners like the U.S. and others that are going to say, you know what, we're on a different economic track and we're not going to buy that stuff anymore, and that will get our attention.
Okay. Karen, fine.
I'm going to give an example which predates me, and I'm going to get the details wrong. But there is an interesting precedent. There's a set of issues I'll mention, but the first one I want to mention, it picks up on your point, last point, Chris. To what extent could pressure internationally result in changes domestically? Think about the whole debate about exporting hydroelectricity from Quebec to New York, this interesting alliance of the Cree, Canadian environmental groups, and U.S. groups who said, we don't want that kind of power, of hydropower. So I think there is great potential and actually growing movement to enact those sorts of pressures here domestically. I actually don't think it's the strongest mechanism. It's one short-term mechanism. I've got three other ideas. So I think we need, in response to your question, change at the provincial level. Manitoba has a Ministry of Water Stewardship, just created a few years ago. Great. We all need one. Every province, every jurisdiction. They need to get together and harmonize certain aspects of water governance. Start with drinking water standards. Why not? The CCME, a great vehicle for a pan-Canadian water strategy on water security, resourced in order to provide a forum for sharing lessons learned. We've got great examples across the country of delegated water governance. We don't effectively share them. How many people in BC know what's happening even in Alberta? Finally, I'm going to steal an idea from Ralph Pentland. All of this won't work unless we have sticks. In the US, they have sticks. They do in the EU, too. One of the major drivers for improvement of water quality in the UK over the past 20 years has been legal action by the European Union. At the European Union level, they sue member states if they don't comply with their legislation. A great stick. In the U.S., public trust law. If the governments don't comply with their own legislation, because they have a duty under public trust law to safeguard the public goods of which they are the stewards, someone can sue. We don't have an analogous mechanism here in Canada. I know this is completely unrealistic, but it is one of the key mechanisms, which I didn't mention earlier, which enable change to be pushed forward in these jurisdictions and not in Canada.
Okay, and just quickly on the bilateral, historically, one of the reasons that the IJC, the International Joint Commission, was created a century ago was management of Great Lakes water issues, right? Yeah. Okay, Emmanuelle and her colleagues from the MISC here are going to circulate with the microphones. House of Commons rules, you can make a declaration, you can have a preamble, you can make a speech, you can ask a question, but you only get 30 seconds.
Thank you. Thanks to all the panelists. That was wonderful. I think that's
sorry, could you just state your name and affiliation, please?
I'm Celeste Cote. I'm the National Water Campaigner for Sierra Club Canada. So I generally have one foot with trying to talk to community members and do education and engagement there, and one foot trying to talk to decision makers and do education and engagement there. And one thing that folks have been asking me on a political level is, okay, we understand that we need to take action on water issues. Platforms, people are starting to think about these kinds of things. How do we sell that idea? Because for those of us in this room, we know that we need a pan-Canadian water strategy. But pan-Canadian water strategy on a political platform doesn't really get people excited. So what are some, I think, hot-button issues or ways to make this more... I'm a water nerd. I get excited about water anyway. But for those of my friends that aren't into this stuff, how do we get them excited?
Okay, let's try and move this one a little more quickly. Okay, guys, who wants to take that?
Okay, first of all, I think that one of the ways that it works in this is making water the meaning and measure of so many other things. And I think water is an absolutely irreplaceable vehicle for. Getting into larger ecosystem issues, to tie into climate change, and also as the indicator of what's happening locally. And I think by charging those views, I think you can get it on the political agenda.
Anybody else want to take that?
Can I just clarify, actually?
Because water is seen as such a complex issue, how do you simplify it? And I don't want to say dumb it down, but be like, if you're going to have a platform point, how do you, you know, if you have 30 seconds or one point in a platform or a few points,
I think you have to. If you're going to do that, you have to pick the single most representative issue locally to do that with, and pick the one that. Allows you to address all the most diverse issues with respect to what water is and does in the place in which you live. And I think that's one way of doing it. But I'd be happy to talk to you more about it.
Emma, I think something that's beginning to attract quite a bit of attention is the backsliding of the Great Lakes. We spent a lot of money, U.S. and Canada spent over $5 billion to clean up the Great Lakes in the 80s or so. And they responded magnificently. But they're now backsliding, and we're seeing serious problems of Lake Erie going back to a eutrophic state, algal growths along the shorelines, and, of course, it's happening in Lake Winnipeg, too. And those issues really capture the people's imagination, I think. And I think if we use the things that really, as Bob says, that really affect people close to where they live, they can see the need for approaching water issues.
Emma, next one.
Hugh Whiteley, Canadian Water Resources Association, and yes, I recognize that the preamble remark I'm going to make applies.
You're only going to get 30 seconds, though.
Restricting water discussions to the category of resource seems to me to be a great limitation. There are three other very important dimensions: the human health dimension, the ecological environmental sustenance dimension, and, as was mentioned yesterday in passing, the very important spiritual dimension. And so I'm wondering if a way to get away from concentrating on the resource only would be, as Karen mentioned, to establish a water ministry at both the federal level and at all the provincial and territorial levels, following the Australian example. So other panelists might want to comment on that.
Great question. Who wants to take it?
I'll jump in.
Take it, Chris.
I actually think that's a great idea, with the caveat that it can't be a single-line department that becomes ghettoized within a larger institution. You have to have the linkages all over the place. I mean, this gets back to the tar sands issues, right? The challenge that we have is it's about energy production, it's about environmental and sustainability, and yet all the people within individual departments that work on those separate sections don't work together, and they don't work together with the people in the other departments. So if you can find a way of having that kind of ministry of water at both the provincial, territorial, and federal level, with all the linkages into all the appropriate line ministries that require consultation with and collaborative work with, I think that's a fantastic idea.
I'd like to just make one quick comment on that, too. I think when you're dealing with water, you have to have cross-ministry cooperation. And a real reform has to go right to the senior cabinet level with almost all ministries. But I agree completely with you, Hugh, that water ministries would work and perhaps establish a different relationship, and maybe through CCME you could do that. But I would caution you that the water departments that you, ministries that you create, can't be subsidiary to energy. They must be the equivalent of.
On this side, hang on.
Good morning. I'm Diane Katz. I'm with the Fraser Institute. I think we all recognize there's finite resources to devote to water protection, and there's been emphasis here on dealing with water in the context of climate change, but given the great uncertainties there are in terms of whether there is climate change and what's causing it, I want to ask the panel whether it was justified to perhaps focus on problems such as infrastructure, urban water infrastructure, because cities are losing 20% to 40% of their water through leaks, or sewer overflows that are flushing wastewater directly into fresh water. So whether we need to put more of our resources on those immediate, very discernible problems rather than hypothetical ones.
Yes, Karen, go ahead.
So I suppose the issue of discernible problems varies greatly depending on where in Canada you live. If you live downstream of the tar sands, a discernible problem looks different than if you live in a big city, not to minimize the importance of the backlog in urban infrastructure renewal that exists in Canada. It's true, you're right, it's enormous, and the dollars have not been spent, and now we're seeing the consequences. I would caution, though, against too much emphasis on the urban issue, because, again, I think we've got a handle on it. The greatest threat to drinking water in Canada exists in small and rural communities, so not in urban centers. In most big urban areas, we have some measure of secondary or tertiary treatment, that we've moved away to some degree from creating vulnerabilities for urban populations. And my personal view is if you had to prioritize somewhere, it would be with respect to groundwater-dependent communities for drinking water, small and rural areas, and resource-extractive sectors, where we use 20% of the water consumed in Canada goes to resource-extractive sectors, almost unmonitored and unregulated. So urban is important, but perhaps not everywhere the first priority.
Jim and Bob?
I really agree that we need to pay a lot of attention to our urban infrastructure, and particular leakage of water, although that may be a source of water for groundwater later. but the thing that's happening is with increased intensity of frequency of heavy rain intensities, we're finding that the storm sewer systems that exist or have been put in fairly recently are inadequate to cope with the flows that are occurring. For example, in Toronto, they have had seven 20-year precipitation events over the last 20 years. And that's just one example from thousands across the country. So we have to design the storm sewer systems to accommodate the changing climate to make sure that we don't just to spend a lot of money to create a system that won't work again.
Mark Cadley Carlson once told me that we were down $54 billion in the amount of money that we need to restore and maintain our already existing water infrastructure. So that's certainly a focus. But I agree with Jim, and Jim showed a photograph of the storm in Toronto in August of 2005, and that was the third 100-year event in 20 years, and it caused $400 million worth of damage in 2 hours. So what the concern is, whether people believe in climate change or not, the City of Toronto is concerned that the climate change impacts can damage infrastructure faster than we can build it, and that there may be more places like New Orleans where we simply can't afford to restore after damage. So these are very serious considerations.
Well, we have at least one honorable member in the House, Francis Carpalicia. You have a question? He's not invited to Mr. Ignatieff's conference, but we're happy to have him at this one.
Well, I this is a very important conference for me. I'm very pleased to be here, and thank you for having me, Ian. I guess I'm getting a little grumpy at all the swipes at politicians, but it's okay. We're used to it. On the issue of a water ministry, I presented a motion, essentially, in the House of Commons about 3 years ago, calling on the government to create not a ministry, because I don't think we need more bureaucracy, but a Secretary of State for Water, a junior minister reporting to the Minister of the Environment, who could pull together the strands of a federal responsibility on water, which you know covers about 22 ministries and agencies at the federal level alone, and who could also be the champion for water, who could do the photo ops and give the speeches and work with the provinces and work with the municipalities and work with the international actors on that as well. So the issue was raised. Unfortunately, the motion was defeated, and I won't get into the politics of it, but I really do believe that that's what we need, because otherwise we're going to get bogged down in the morass of the coordinating mechanisms, which are very important, but I don't think they can provide the leadership. I don't think this can be done by committee. I think we need a federal water champion. Thank you.
So that's your 30 seconds. Is there a question there?
Well, do you agree?
Yeah. Okay.
We could all supply anecdotes. Thanks very much for the comment. We could all supply anecdotes about failures of coordination between different federal and provincial departments and agencies. I believe in the mid-1990s, the federal government had to assemble a Where's Water team to figure out where in the world water responsibilities were being housed in the government, much less who was championing them. So I think it's a good idea. And I think it links back to the question raised earlier about selling water as an issue. I don't think we need to convince Canadians. I think they're convinced. I don't think they need a lot more information. I think they're already worried. So this champion would have a natural constituency. So thus it is a good idea, because that champion would have a natural constituency, not to though underestimate or minimize the coordination challenges that that person would face.
Okay, this is our last question. Let's make it quick, guys.
I love that idea of a water champion, and it could take a number of different forms. I always come back to the whatever that is, whether it's a minister of state, whether you actually have a department, you have to have the integrative mechanisms. And anybody that's worked in government before knows that integration happens very well when there are budgets and there is money available to do things. As soon as you start cutting budgets, people will retreat back into their primary mandates, and integration falls apart. So whatever mechanism it is that we do, we develop to have that champion and ensure the integration happens, there have to be the resources there to ensure that that integration is sustainable.
And there's 5 days left in the fiscal year to get it done.
Francis, I think that's a terrific idea, and I think we need a champion. If you'd like to do it, fly at it, and we'll be behind you.
He is doing it, yes.
Well, thank you all for a great opening session. I'm going to turn it back to Bob.
It's my pleasant duty on behalf of us all to thank our panelists and to thank our moderator, and to thank you all for your excellent questions. And I think you've started off this day with a really good and useful punch. You have a 11-minute break.
Thanks very much. That was good. Is that okay? Excellent.